Welcome to Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast for Sunday, April 17th, 2016. The Reverend Ron McHattie is preaching. The sermon today is from the series Encounters with the Resurrected Christ, with today's message being On the Shores, Part 1. The New Testament reading is Ephesians 1, verses 7 and 8.
We'll start working our way through this text once again. And last week we were behind closed doors. This week we're on the shore. The shore specifically is the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. The text, I want to just read this passage that's kind of the transition from where we were last week to this week. John 20, 30 through 31. And this is something for you to be mindful of. John is really good at identifying what his given purpose at a given time is as he writes his gospel account. So, much more so, I think, than either Matthew or Mark. Luke is also very intent in terms of what he's trying to accomplish, as we shared last week. Anyway, in verse 30, we read these words, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you may have life in his name." So John is saying that's the whole purpose of this gospel account. And acknowledges right up front what the intent is. Acknowledges right up front that there are many things in the gospel that aren't recorded elsewhere in the other gospels. But he picked specifically the incidences that he thought highlighted bringing people to a point of understanding the uniqueness of who Jesus Christ was, and hopefully bringing them to a point of belief together. So let's join in beginning in reading in John 21, and we'll read this first group of verses together. "After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he showed himself in this way. Gathered there together were Simon Peter, Thomas called the Twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, John and James, and two others of his disciples. Simon Peter said to them, 'I'm going fishing.' They said to him, 'We will go with you.' They went out, got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing." Now, in that text, Sea of Tiberias is just, that's the same sea as Galilee. Okay, so if you're not familiar with that, two different names that the sea was referred to by. And if you look at a map, if you have a chance to look at the map, Tiberias was a pretty significant Roman settlement, and it's just to the northeast at the top of the Sea of Galilee. And you begin going from Tiberias around to the top of the Sea of Galilee, which really isn't all that far. Then you come into the whole area where where Peter and many of the disciples lived up by Capernaum, and where Jesus had his headquarters, to the best of our knowledge, at Peter's home, seems to be the place where Jesus hung out the most. If you ever have the opportunity to be in the Holy Lands, that area is a phenomenal area. Usually the actual community of Tiberias is usually where you catch what they call the Jesus fishing boats, and you can go out and have a great experience out on the Sea of Galilee. You just have to remember, when you get on those boats, they're bigger than the ones that were used during Jesus' day, and I don't know where they're made now. They were made in Egypt and then brought in at the time that we were there. Just a little bit north of Tiberias, though, it's probably the best preserved fishing boat that dates back to Jesus' time that they've been able to unearth in. So you could go in there and see that. It's just really kind of an amazing situation. As I remember, it's encased in glass because of wood deterioration. They want to slow all of that down and have it in a preserved area. And the Roman Catholics did an amazing thing up at Capernaum. And please, if you have a Roman Catholic background, you know Roman Catholic friends or whatever, I'm not saying this to disc Roman Catholics, but oftentimes Roman Catholics will, well, you know, Protestants during this century have kind of done the same thing. Well, you go over the top in remembering something, building a monument, and in the process of doing it, you ruin the site. The Roman Catholics have built a facility over Peter's home, except it's all elevated so that you can see it the way it actually was, the ruins. I mean, you don't have walls, but you can see the ruins. And then you go up and you can look down into it and stuff. So they preserve the ability not to walk through it and just beat it up, but to really get close. They've really done a phenomenal job there of creating a pilgrimage site without ruining the site itself. So if you're ever there, take advantage of those and go from there. The reason for the names in yellow are that they're at Sea of Tiberias. They're at the northern part, probably outside of Capernaum. And the ones in yellow are the ones that we know for sure among the disciples were fishermen. And the reason why I added Andrew there is that he mentions two other disciples, but doesn't mention their names. There's a really good chance that if Simon Peter said we're going fishing, his brother Andrew would have gone with them. There's pretty good speculation that possibly Simon Peter and Andrew were in business for themselves. Why did they go out fishing at night? The reason for that is in that area of the country, the fish that they basically go after come to the surface at night because the outside temperatures are cooler. And so they come to the surface and they begin feeding at the surface level, and it's easier to catch them. And they basically did their fishing with nets, and so they didn't have to drop their nets so far down into the water. And you say, gosh, you know, I didn't know Ron knew that much about fishing. He knows absolutely nothing about fishing. It's just the books I refer to, okay? So anyway, but just thoughts that come along. But the thought that goes through my mind as I begin reading this, I mean, it's in some ways it's understandable, but it's so true of human nature. Isn't it true among us that sometimes when we face a moment of great disappointment in our life, or we're in a state of confusion, we return to what we know is best, what we know best. So for the disciples, especially those who were fishermen, maybe the other disciples returned to what they did before. They're just, right now, they're just kind of out there in limbo. They still aren't putting all the pieces together of what has transpired. All they know is that Jesus, yes, has risen from the dead, but he's not with them on a 24-hour basis. He comes and goes. And they never know when he's going to show up. So what are you going to do in this state of limbo? You go back to what you always knew. And so, they're, you know, for those, at least for five of them, most likely they were back on those boats, re-earning an income for their families and re-establishing themselves, not really knowing what the future would hold. So then we pick it up in verse 4, and I'll read here, it's just a short bit. Just after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" They answered him, "No." You wonder what that no was like. You know, after a whole night and not catching anything, I figure there's probably a little bit of irritation in that no. And he said to them, "Cast the net to the right side of the boat and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. Some of the questions that come to my mind as I'm reading that is, how desperate were they that someone that they didn't even recognize up on the shore at that time, that they would even heed that person's directions? Was there something in Jesus' voice that was very authoritarian that just caused them to think, okay, maybe this person knows what they're think. They know something, and we're going to go ahead and do it. One of the resources I've read, I didn't like where they kept pushing it. I felt like they kept pushing it too far. But they did raise an interesting thought in the context of this passage, and that was that miracles take place when we follow God's directives. And I'm not sure that I would endorse that 100%. It has to do with context, but I think it's worthy of us noting. Is it possible that some of the things that we desire for and yearn for in our lives don't transpire because we don't follow God's directives? And as a result, we don't place ourselves in a position for God to be able to work. And I do believe that. But I just feel like, you know, you can also press it too far and take it totally out of context where all of a sudden it can be terribly abused. But I think it's interesting that oftentimes, I remember someone saying one time, why, until you know you can trust your child, most of us are very unwilling to hand over the keys of the car. You know, until we're relatively certain that they're going to heed the, you know, the basic rules of the road and not do something stupid. I mean, it's a huge step to turn over the keys of the car to someone. That's the reason why when you get to that point in life, as some of you know, it's always nice to have an old one available. You know, and make them earn the right to drive the car that works decent. But you know, you kind of put that in the context of our Christian walk. Does God hold back on certain things because he's not, you know, we're not mature enough yet to know how to handle what blessings that God could bestow upon us, and we could really blow it? It's kind of like the studies in the lottery. If all of the studies are correct, the lotteries are really more of a curse than a benefit. More people's lives have been ruined because they won one of the lotteries than they have been blessed. We just don't know how to deal with the influx of all of that wealth. And then aren't prepared for how we get taken advantage of when they receive that. So then let's keep going. Pick up with me in verse 7. That should have been then. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on some clothes, for he was naked, and jumped into the sea. But the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. So this conversation's going on back and forth at 100 yards. That's pretty amazing. One of the things, the Sermon on the Mount was probably done just a little bit to the east of Capernaum. But the way the hills come down into that area, people who deal in acoustics and stuff, they say it's a really unique area in the world in terms of how the hills come down. And so that you can speak and your voice really gets projected. So I don't know if some of that gets picked up when you're down on the shore and it keeps projecting out. But you know, this is what John recorded for us. You wonder what's going on here. There's a lot of interesting things that are going on. If you go back to Luke 5, I didn't write it out partially for room, and also because I hope that you take the time to go and look some of this stuff up for yourself and look at it. But in Luke 5, there's another incident of Jesus meeting the disciples in a morning and asking them if they caught anything. They said no, and again, the same instruction. So you wonder what that dialogue was there at that time. Could have been some recall going on in the back of this happened once before and it worked, and that they're slowly putting together the pieces that, gosh, it's Jesus that's on the shore. This is not the incident in Luke 5 when Peter responds by getting out of the boat in the storm and walking on water. So there are some differences, and in that incident, they were not fishing. But there is a fishing incident that's very similar to this one, except it finishes with that word, "I'm going to cause you to become fishers of men." And that's probably one of the very initial times when Jesus begins helping them understand what the future is going to hold, even though I'm sure at that moment in time they were absolutely clueless. But as they, you know, you begin going back in recall, we all have those moments of recall. We go, oh, well, now that makes sense. And, oh, yeah, I remember that. And you can see why you're where you are. So, but I, the another question I came up here with that goes through my mind, you may have different questions as you go through this stuff, but these are just some of the questions that come to my mind. How often do we fail to follow God's calling in our lives? Jesus said to Simon Peter, it goes on, do not be afraid, from now on you will be catching people in Luke 5. But, you know, there's something that happens and there's a calling and we don't respond to it. And then, you know, God has to speak to us more than once before we finally get the message, oh, well, maybe, you know, this is what I ought to be doing. Possibly the closest thing in my life to that going on is just learning how to be a pastor in California. Because when Jim and I came in 1968 to California to go to school at Fuller, you know, all the intention was, in when we finished with grad school, we were heading back to, from our perspective, where we were raised, to God's country. You know, God did not live, I mean, there's some pretty places in California, but God did not live in California if you were from Oregon, Washington, or Idaho. I mean, that was just not feasible. Even though the people in Oregon, Washington, Idaho don't acknowledge God, by according to all the statistics, they knew that God did not live in California. But after I was ordained and I was in my first call, I was, you know, phenomenal things were happening in ministry, but I was personally really miserable for about the first 10 years. Because I was doing everything possible to get to back home. To get our parents off our backs about, aren't you guys ever coming back to the area? And different things like that, and dynamics. And some people would say, well, you were living in Richmond at that time. No wonder you wanted to try to get back. But that wasn't part of the scenario at that time. But just nothing ever happened. And I've never come in second so many times in my entire life than during those 10 years. Every call I went through, I came in second on. I got so tired of coming in second. And the worst one was I was being considered for the church in Edmonds, and it sits on the water in Puget Sound. I mean, it's just so spectacular. And I remember meeting with their committee after my weekend with them, and they said, we're absolutely convinced that you're the best candidate, but we're calling the other person. You know, so that was not what I wanted to hear, and I said, why? And they said, because there's too much California in you. And I just was like, you've got to be kidding, you know. So I came home from that really, really angry is not the appropriate word at God, but if I say it, that's also not the appropriate word to share at this time. But but then it was at that point where I just said, okay, God, it looks like, and to Jim, it looks like we're in California. I can at least say to my folks and your folks, we've tried. If you got a problem with it, take it up with God. But it looks like we're in California. And, you know, we've been here 30 years since. You know, we're going on to almost 50 years in California. And you know what? God does live in California. And we're really happy in California. And God has blessed us abundantly. But that was a hard time in my life, coming to terms with the fact that we weren't going to California. I mean, we weren't going to Washington. God had other plans for us. So picking it up in verse 9, when they had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. One of the things that some of the people in the commentaries bring up, Jesus asked them for fish, but he already has fish on the fire. Where did he get the fish? Well, you know, since he's God, you know, he can do what he wants to do, but interesting comment. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them, and though there were so many, the net was not torn. That was amazing. And the reason for the counting of the fish is that's just what fishermen in that day did. They would go out in a boat, they would bring them in, they would count how many fish were caught that day, and then they would divide them up between themselves, and then they would go to the markets or whatever and sell them, and that's how they provided for themselves. So for them to be knowing exactly how many fish were brought in was right on target in terms of what would go on. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Now, none of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? Because they knew it was the Lord. So there was some visual disconnect, it would appear. They recognized, but they didn't recognize at the same time. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. One of the most helpful tools that you could ever have is called a chronological Bible. And what it does is that it takes both the Old Testament and the New Testament, and to the best of their ability, they put all of those events in chronological order. So like in the Gospels, as you read it on the margin, it'll tell you in which one of the Gospels they were doing this. But scholars have spent years trying to figure out the exact placement of what was going on. If you have one of those Bibles and you're reading through it, you'll realize this is not the third time Jesus appeared. But you have to understand this is a men-dominated culture, so that when Jesus appeared to the women, it didn't count. All right? So we're actually in either appearance 4 or 5, depending on how you try to put the pieces together. But if you're reading through that, you're going, hey, you know, what's up with John? He's just a guy in his day and age, you know, and, you know, the gals just didn't count at that point in time in terms of reliability. So don't get all in a fuss about it. Just be aware of that if you read through it. I want to come back to this meal in just a minute. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, some of you will remember this. I went through this text during Advent when we were talking about the candle of love. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Obviously, the disciples. He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my lambs. A second time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter felt hurt, because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. On the back of your sermon notes, I summarized the lesson that we went through during Advent in terms of the play of words that goes on with that word love. Because Jesus and Peter are using two different words. Jesus is using unconditional love. Peter's using love as a friend. And the third time, possibly one reason why Peter is so hurt, not only the memory of the three times of denial, but Jesus changes the word and he adapts his word of love from unconditional love to Simon, do you love me as a friend? And that had to have been extremely painful for Peter to see what was going on in all of that. And you know, it just had to have been very painful, because it really caused Peter to have to look at himself right straight in the face, in a sense, and come to terms with where he was and where he wasn't. Now, the thing that sometimes we miss here, I think, is I don't know for how many years I probably read this, because Jesus usually is pretty sensitive to people's feelings. So, you know, you read past what you don't want to read, or you see what you want to see in a text. I mean, we all do that all the time in life. And I always assume that Jesus kind of like, with one of the incidences where he heals someone who is blind, takes him aside so the person isn't the center of attention, and he's having this little conversation with Peter. Little conversation that would big results. The problem is, How would anyone have known this unless Peter talked about it afterwards? But more than that, the text, when you look at it real closely, implies that they were all present when Jesus asked the question. I mean, Peter was really on the spot, because it would appear that all the other six are there with him when Jesus says that. And when he says, more than these, wow, what a moment of great discomfort. Brings me back to the question that we admitted, though. Is there more happening here than what meets the eye? So one of the things I love is, after all these years, I run across a resource that shares something about the text that I didn't know before. In the Middle East, at least at that time, I'm assuming it probably is practiced in some areas even to this day, when there has been a wrong committed, when someone has failed you, one of the signs that forgiveness has been granted is to invite someone to sit down and have a meal with you. And that invitation to have a meal means you're forgiven. So we put all the focus on Peter's denial. But if you go back and you reread the dialogue and what's happening at the time of the crucifixion, all of the disciples desert Jesus except one. And when you get to the cross, the only one that's there is John. It's John and the women. All of the rest of the disciples are gone. They're all in hiding, fearing for their well-being. So, I mean, it makes even more sense why Jesus looks at John from the cross and says, John, behold your mother, Mom, behold your son. You know, as he's entrusting Mary's care, there aren't any other disciples there to entrust her care to. There's only John. So, knowing that, now having the resurrection and everything, that meal on the beach was for more people than just Peter. It was for all of those disciples. It was the door of opening it up, of reestablishing and restoring a relationship with all of them, and saying, you know, I forgive each and every one of you. Huge. I mean, that's just huge. How amazing. Was it last week, David, when we sang Amazing Grace or Amazing Love? I think it was. Can't remember. But, you know, yeah. Did we really? Okay, all right. Yeah, got it, yeah. Well, you know, the Spirit works all the time. So. This is the takeaway from this morning as I look at all of this in the text. Always be mindful of God's unconditional love, in parenthesis, forgiveness, and be willing to practice it. And be willing to practice it. This is an amazing text on God's forgiveness and reinforcing that forgiveness. And forgiveness is a big topic in Scripture. I'm going to get into that a little bit in a message in May. But I don't think it's underscored any more significantly than in the Lord's Prayer. I mean, doesn't it distress you when we're praying the Lord's Prayer? It distresses me significantly. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Ooh. Yeah, that would be a great prayer if it just left off the last half of that sentence. There's a part of me where I want to go, you really don't mean that, do you, Jesus? I mean, you're really not going to enforce that one. I hope you're really not going to enforce that one, because if you do, then I possibly don't stand a prayer. Maybe Jesus' response to me is, well, then do something about it. But I don't think the words could be any stronger than that little phrase that we need to try to write relationships if we're able to. And Paul writes in Romans, try to live at peace with all people, if at all possible. So how I interpret that is, and putting it in the context of forgiveness, God's encouraging us to make relationships right. They may not ever become right, but the reason that they don't become right should not weigh upon us as being the reason. It's our responsibility to keep trying to open the door, to try to bring about forgiveness, trying to bring about rightness. And that's tough, but it's a reality. And as I look at this text and how Jesus in this meal is extending that forgiveness to everyone present, you know, I think that's the key to it for us this morning is, are we willing to keep, do everything possible to extend forgiveness? Doesn't mean that people don't have to account for, you know, the wrong they've committed, but we don't have to hold the grudge and we don't have to hold an unforgiving heart forever. When we do practice unforgiveness, it typically takes a horrific toll on ourselves. And we'll talk a little bit about that more as well. So, as we make a transition into our closing for this morning, words of thanksgiving.
You have been listening
this morning from anyone?
Community Presbyterian Church Sermon Podcast. To learn more about Community Presbyterian Church and its ministries, come visit us at 2800 Georgia Street in Vallejo, California. Or visit our website, cpcvallejo.org. You can also email us at cpcvallejo@sbcglobal.net. Have a blessed day.